At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about The Sawmill, episode 10 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. If you have not listened to the episode we're going to be talking about, pause this podcast, go back and listen, and then come back and listen to this conversation. We will still be here when you do. We have a super special guest today. Preet Bharara served as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York from 2009 to 2017. He oversaw the investigations and litigation of all criminal and civil cases. His team of assistant U.S. attorneys handled cases involving terrorism, financial fraud, public corruptions, and organized crime. The New York Times dubbed Bharara as one of, quote, the nation's most aggressive and outspoken prosecutors. But he is now the host of Stay Tuned with Preet, a podcast focused on the issues of power, policy, and justice. And he has a new podcast, Doing Justice, which is based on his best-selling book and explores cases his office prosecuted while he was U.S. attorney. Preet Bharara, welcome to Undisclosed. It is such a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a treat to be here. Thank you.
And also with us is Susan Simpson. Of course, she's one of the hosts of Undisclosed, the lead investigator on the Jeff Titus case. She's also a lawyer and pretty much our favorite Nancy Drew. Hello, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
So, Preet, you don't mind if I call you Preet, do you?
No, since that's my name. I think you can call me Preet.
You know, when you've seen people on television listen to their podcast, sometimes you feel like you know them better than they know you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, or better than I know myself, perhaps.
So you started your podcast, Stay Tuned, in 2017 after being ousted famously by President Trump shortly after he took office. Tell me about switching from lawyering to podcasting. Is this what you always imagined you'd be doing when you went to law school?
I mean, there was barely the internet when I went to law school, so I don't think I was thinking about podcasting. Well, I certainly wasn't even thinking about being the United States attorney. I was just trying to pass law school. How is it different? What's different about it? Well, and the biggest adjustment, probably losing subpena power.
Oh my gosh.
That's kind of a bummer.
This job would be so much easier if I could subpoena my witnesses. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, and you can't compel them to testify. When you talk to them, there's no grand jury, there's no FBI agent, so it's a little bit different. But look, in some ways, it's kind of the same. I was given a nice compliment by a guest I had on the Stay Tuned podcast in the last week on Twitter, and someone responded and said, well, obviously he was trained to ask questions as a lawyer and as a prosecutor. Of course he asked, you know, good questions. I think that's a little bit true because, you know, when you ask questions as a lawyer and particularly as a prosecutor who's also conducting investigations, it's not like what you see on television where it's all, you know, harsh cross-examination. In fact, prosecutors don't cross-examine that much because defendants rarely testify. But in the lead-up, in building your case, when you want people to talk to you, this is true of detectives and agents also, you have to build a rapport with folks. You have to be a normal person. You're not sort of just shouting staccato questions at them. You're trying to get them to tell a story. And so, you know, there's a little bit of that storytelling training that goes on when you're a trial lawyer, and probably that translates a little bit. So I've always been very comfortable asking people questions. and getting them to tell stories. So maybe the transition was a little bit easier for that reason.
Hmm. I'm thinking, though, about that old adage, you know, but prosecutors and lawyers in the courtroom shouldn't ask a question they don't know the answer to,
right.
Which is the opposite of what you do when you interview. You should probably mostly ask questions that you actually want the answer to, because maybe you don't know or you don't think the audience knows. Has that been at all difficult for you to just kind of sometimes maybe go in a little bit blinder to these conversations?
Well, I think that's a great way of putting it, and I think you put your finger on something important. The best advice I got when I started doing a podcast was, if you're curious about the subject and you're curious about the person, and that curiosity is obvious, and you're trying to learn something at the same time that the listener is learning something, that's compelling, broadcast, audio content.
Right.
And so, obviously, if you're curious, by definition, you don't know the answers to the questions you're asking. So when people talk about their jobs or their craft or, what they learned about someone who is the subject of their biography, I like to prepare a lot. That doesn't mean you're not preparing. So when they give an answer, you have some knowledge about what they've written or what they've done or about the subject matter. So you can ask a good and intelligent follow-up. But yeah, a lot of the time, the best answers I get are ones that are surprising, where I don't know the answer. So luckily it's not a trial, it's just a podcast.
So there's something that I've always thought I would ask you, speaking of questions you don't know the answer to, if I ever had the chance to talk to you. I grew up
math?
No,
not math.
I grew up in the greater New York area. I'm from Long Island originally. And
Long Island.
I'll tell you, in my lifetime, I've moved where I live now a long time ago, but in my lifetime, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York was never a thing that people really knew a lot about. And now it is a very prominent, very important, and very public focus for people interested in politics and law. What was it like having that position at a time when people are really paying attention to what that office is doing?
Well, I think, we're a little bit self-important in the Southern District. Sometimes we've been accused of. And independent in various ways. The nickname for the Southern District, if you're from there, you think of it in a good way this way. And if you don't, you think it's a pejorative, but we're kind of known as the Sovereign District of New York. So, we like to think that at all times going back, Bob Morgenthau was the U.S. attorney for a long time. There have been other prominent U.S. attorneys going back to the founding of the Republic. When I used to swear people in, not to get overly dramatic and sentimental, but the District of New York, before there were four districts, was established at the same time that the Republic was. And the first nominee to be the United States Attorney was on a piece of paper that also had the nominee to be the first Secretary of State, and that was Thomas Jefferson. So the history goes back a lot, and so it's a weighty thing to inherit an office. And Rudy Giuliani, who has had better days, was quite the subject of attention when he was the United States Attorney. He's still the subject of attention, but in a far different and not good way, if you want to talk about that. Yeah, there's a lot of responsibility because not only are all the cases important. We used to say at trial, we had a line that assistant U.S. attorneys would use. We say, this case is important to the defendant, but it's also important to the government. Every case is important to the person who is being tried for a crime and their family. It's the most important thing in their life. But it's also very important for people to see that justice is done. We always say justice must not only be done, it must be seen to be done. So it's a heavy, heavy responsibility. And given the legacy of the office and how many important cases it's done and how much in the spotlight it has been, at any given moment, you're not sort of able to do your work often quietly because we have big ticket investigations and big ticket defendants. And sometimes they're, famous politicians or, rich people who are billionaires. And there's a lot of scrutiny. And with scrutiny comes additional responsibility and care to getting it right. So, it's a little nerve-wracking, but you get used to it.
When you left the office, I assume you were in the middle of things that you were sort of excited to continue working on and finish.
I was.
Have you been kind of like extra paying attention to see if those matters are still unfolding?
Well, it's been a while now. It'll be 4 years in March. So, yeah, at the beginning, of course, and you look and see announcements. And the funny thing is, I don't know if this is funny or not, but the circumstances of my firing were unusual. It's not generally unusual, but Donald Trump had asked me to stay, shook my hand, looked me in the face and said, I really want you to stay. Then not long after he took office, his people asked me to resign. But, you know, when decisions were made about cases that I had been seeing and people didn't like the result, they assumed there was some interference because of the circumstances of my firing. And I don't think that was the case, at least with respect to things that were in progress when I left. But, yeah, of course, you look with great curiosity. And, you know, the great thing is people assume I have some inside knowledge and people tell me secrets. They don't.
Yeah.
The tradition of the office is you keep your mouth shut, you do your cases. And I learn about the cases just like everyone else by seeing the press release or by seeing the news story.
So you're not still on the office Slack channel or whatever, getting the goss, as
you
the
are,
young people say.
You are, let me tell you something about federal prosecutors. They are behind the times with technology. The biggest, when I was a U.S. attorney, I would go speak to various institutions. And I went to Silicon Valley and I spoke to a tech company for reasons that are not important. And the biggest laugh I got out of them when I was trying to explain to them how, you know, backward we are at the DOJ, I said, up until last year, we were still using a program called WordPerfect.
Yes.
Like, what is that?
Yes, I remember WordPerfect. It was
good. We didn't get iPhones until until the very recent past.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's Slack going on at DOJ.
You were talking a minute ago about, you know, sort of the weight of being a prosecutor in that office. And on Undisclosed, there's a lot of bad faith prosecutions that are covered, you know, through the cases that this team looks at. And a common theme is the adversarial nature of the justice system and the strong desire that prosecutors have sometimes of just winning convictions rather than getting to the truth. Did you feel those pressures when you were a prosecutor?
No. And I think it's very important you expose that kind of thinking because it's dangerous, it's wrong, it's antithetical to the oath. And the culture at SDNY, some of which, you know, a lot of which I explore in this new podcast that we just launched called Doing Justice, based on my book of the same name, Doing Justice, is that it's not about winning. And people who speak in those terms and say that their job is to secure a conviction have it exactly wrong. And if people talk that way in interviews when I was looking to hire new prosecutors, we didn't hire them. The job is to do justice, make sure you do the right thing in the right way for the right reasons. That's the theme of the book, the theme of the podcast. And that's no better exemplified than the first episode of the podcast is about a case where there was a bad prosecution. Hmm. The bad prosecution was done by the Bronx DA's office 17 years earlier. And for reasons that people can understand, because I don't want to give away the whole story, a homicide investigator in my office came across evidence that made it clear that there were people in prison who shouldn't be in prison. And even though his whole job has been helping to prosecute people and put them away, he understood that in that moment, his duty, his responsibility, his obligation was not to keep the conviction of this other office, but to undo the conviction.
Oh.
And that's what he did.
What a breath of fresh air.
Prosecutor's job, like sometimes the job of the prosecutor is always to do justice, you know, the title of the book, title of the podcast. But justice isn't always getting the conviction or the harshest sentence or the most number of people in an indictment. I have a whole chapter in my book called Walking Away. And the reason, you know, I didn't feel that pressure, the reason I didn't feel that pressure in answer to your question is when I went into that office, you know, 20 years ago, 21 years ago, the U.S. attorney at the time, Mary Jo White, said all the things that I tried to emulate and say later. And that is, you know, you sometimes judge a prosecutor in a prosecutor's office not by the cases they bring, but by the cases they don't bring. Hmm. And sometimes it's not just to bring a case. Sometimes you could probably get a conviction because of the nature of the case or the sentimentality of it or the identity of the defendant. But you don't do that if it's not right to do. And sometimes you get criticism for that, too. Hmm. I got criticized as a U.S. attorney, and people in my office did, sometimes because we were thought to be too tough, too harsh, and sometimes because we weren't tough enough. And you know, we didn't take away people in chains who, based on newspaper reporting, folks thought were guilty of crimes. You know, proving a crime against someone is very hard, and it should be. And I hope, you know, when you look at these stories, the prosecutors themselves respect that. Hmm. So, you know, from time to time, I get asked, you know, what more powers did you want as a prosecutor? What could have helped you bring more prosecutions? And I would say, and I would kind of surprise people, I don't know that you want to give prosecutors more power. And I'm saying that as a prosecutor, we can barely, you know, handle the enormous and immense and awesome power that we have now. Hmm. So think twice before you give prosecutors additional power. I mean, obviously there are things to improve and there are reforms and there may be easier ways to get evidence, but you know, we give prosecutors a whole, you said I could curse.
Oh yeah,
before.
Do it.
A shit ton of discretion and power. And I think the important thing, which I try to explore in the podcast and in the book, is how to get people who are on the prosecution side and on the other side, frankly, to pay attention to how to do things in a thoughtful and correct way.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier the importance of not just doing justice, but having that justice be seen, be done. And I often wonder if that cuts the other way in post-conviction cases. And it seems like there's resistance there, not necessarily to the case of a particular defendant, but a sense that if the DA's office or the prosecutor recognizes a wrongful conviction, if they recognize a problem there, as if they'll lose credibility for the entire office.
Right.
And that having that be seen is itself a problem for justice.
And the cops,
and that
too,
motivates,
right?
Yeah. And that they're
I
afraid
think it's completely
that
wrong.
Finding
I think that's completely, I mean, to me, that turns everything on its head.
And it does. But on the other hand, it's a true, it, I mean,
yeah,
I think
it may
a,
be. It may
it's
be.
A good point. But
if, you know, like if there are prosecutors listening or, you know, heads of prosecutors' offices listening, I think you need to do something very important and create a culture in which, and this is true in all institutions, by the way, and I talk about this a lot in other contexts, you need to create a culture in which it is not only okay to admit error, but you're celebrated for doing so, right? Not only is it a climate in which you're encouraged to admit error and fix things that you've gotten wrong, but that is seen as something very, very good. And the opposite needs to also be true, that if it becomes known that you've kept your mouth shut about a Brady violation or some disclosure issue, that you will be a pariah in that office because that's not how you do things and you bring disrepute upon the office. And I think it's the case that, look, how often is that going to happen? If you have an office where you bring, you know, righteous conviction after conviction after conviction, and there comes a day when it becomes clear that there was something that shouldn't have happened, and you take the time and effort, like the people that I described in my first podcast episode, then I think you develop a reputation for fairness and integrity. I mean, that's integrity, right? That when you see something that went wrong, you undo it. And I think that the good, look, unless it's, you know, a monumental number of things, right? Like, you know, you had 50 cases that went wrong, then you got a different kind of problem. But I would like to think that you enhance the reputation of the office. You enhance the reputation of law enforcement that is under attack in some cases, quite rightly, based on things that we've seen that are horrible on our TV screens. But if you can point to instances where you've corrected wrongs, I think you build a lot of credibility in the community.
So I think especially outside of the federal system and like state DA's offices, what I see a lot is a lack of reward for that kind of behavior. There's no electoral benefit. There's no reputational benefit. If the DA's office can just stand firm, and one particular jurisdiction I've worked in, they've declared to us that we've never had a wrongful conviction. It's not going to start now. And if they can convince the community and the voters there that there isn't a problem, never has been one, there can only be a benefit to the office by holding that line.
Yeah, I mean, that's just not my way of thinking. You know, in this first episode of Doing Justice, that is, in fact, you know, what happened. You know, we went to John O'Malley, the investigator in my office, went to the Bronx DA's office, and I understand the impulse. Look, they brought a case, they tried it, a jury bought it, a judge affirmed it, a court of appeals affirmed it. What could have gone wrong here? There was not an open-mindedness to it because people don't like to admit error, even if it was in the distant past. And even if some of those people have moved on, but I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. I just do. And at the end of the day, it shouldn't require some, you know, tangible, palpable reward like publicity or stepping stone to elected office. It should be because it's the right thing. The job is to do the right thing. The job is to do justice. And look, I mean, it sounds corny. It's, you know, there are a lot of corny things about being in government service. And one of them is the job is its own reward. Doing the right thing is its own reward. So people look, this exoneration that was done by my office, although it wasn't, you know, our office's prosecution, I would have been just as proud if it had been one of our office's own prosecutions from 17 years earlier. And I think, I really do think in the long term and in the wider community, doing things like that enhances your reputation.
Hmm. I really want to hear more about your podcast, Doing Justice. So what is the gist of it? What is it going to sound like?
Sounds awesome.
Why are you making it? Like, what made you want to make it?
So the first thing is I got fired, as you know.
Famously.
And then I had some time, and people started contacting me about writing a book. So I wrote this book called Doing Justice, which is, you know, a meditation on what it means to do the right thing, how you engage in ethical decision-making, because it's not so easy. And I also thought that people didn't really understand the world of prosecutors, of ethical prosecutors, and assume, and you have some evidence of this from your podcast, but I don't think they're all that way, and we were certainly, I hope, not that way. It wasn't always about winning and convictions. It's about making sure that justice is ultimately done. And I wanted to explain to people through stories of, you know, many, many cases that I oversaw, how things can go right and how things can go wrong. So I wrote this book. It did very well. And then I started doing this podcast, the Stay Tuned podcast, and it occurred to me, why don't I merge the two things that I've learned how to do, you know, oversee criminal cases and also produce a podcast. And so I've taken six for this first season, and hopefully there will be more seasons. I've taken six stories that I mentioned in the book and make them come alive by interviewing the people. So in this exoneration case, you'll hear the voices of the homicide investigator, John O'Malley. You'll hear the voice of the head of my violent crime unit, Margaret Garnett, talking about the decision-making. You'll hear the voice of the of one of the men, Eric Lisson, who was wrongfully convicted, and his lawyer. And sort of in narrative format, we tell the story of how it came to light that he shouldn't have been in prison and other people shouldn't have been in prison, and how we fought to get him out of prison. And we do the same thing in every episode. You know, we have an episode in the podcast that's one of the most crazy stories in the book and one of the most crazy stories from my time in office. You may remember this because it was on the cover of the New York Post days in a row, where we charged an active duty cop with a kidnapping conspiracy in connection with what looked like his intent to kidnap,
yes,
rape,
the cannibal
murder,
cop. Is that what you're talking about?
And cannibalize.
Yes.
Yeah, so I hope you're not eating, folks. So we have a whole episode devoted to how that unfolded, what the decision-making process was like. How do you decide if something's a thought crime, not a thought crime? We have an episode about one of the, you know, not every case was on the front page of the paper. I think it's some of my favorite stories, both in the podcast and in the book, are ones that nobody ever heard of. And one of my favorites is the story of a sex worker who was brutally beaten and robbed of money in her apartment. And a person like that, how do you ever think they're going to get their day in court, right? Who's going to believe that person? And there were really courageous law enforcement agents and a prosecutor in my office who said, yeah, she should get her day in court. Her name is Sue Ann. And there's a whole episode about her and how someone like that, particularly in this age of Me Too, and, you know, pre-Me Too, where powerful people think that they can abuse less powerful people and get away with it because who's going to believe them? This is sort of an echo of that kind of story. So I wanted the stories to come alive in audio format so people could get a little closer and hear the actual voices of the people who are the heroes of those stories, not just read about them.
So one of the questions I have for you, and really anytime I get to talk to a prosecutor, is there has been this enormous shift in the American perception of the criminal justice system, really, I think, spurred by the podcast Serial. The, you know, book deals now are being made about wrongful convictions. Documentaries are being made about potential wrongful convictions. We used to hear true crime stories. Bad guy does something. Cops get bad guy gets convicted. But now there is this huge, overwhelming interest in things like Brady violations and prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct and people who are in prison who shouldn't be, false confessions and so forth. Is it gratifying to you to see this shift take place in the culture?
Well, what's gratifying to me is anything that shifts in the culture that causes more justice and more fairness, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. Again, I think you started it off exactly correctly to mention this issue of what is the metric? First of all, metrics are a difficult thing. If you're in the business of prosecution or criminal justice, you're not in the widget-making business. So metrics are, I think, a dangerous thing to begin with. Yeah, so it's great. Look, if there are improvements in technology such that the DNA evidence can come to light and exonerate people, look, there's nothing more pure, even more pure than taking a bad person off the street who might kill or rape other human beings. Even more satisfying, I think, in the eyes of justice is undoing an injustice, right? That, you know, a form of justice is undoing injustice. And if there are ways to improve techniques or courtroom rules or technology or anything else that allows the undoing of injustice, which unfortunately happens in the world, in part because people are fallible and some people are just quite bad, I think that's all for the better. Bring it on. What I do worry about, and this might not be the most popular thing for people, some of the people listening to this podcast, is I don't think we go overboard. I think it is very important and good to be critical and scrutinize prosecutors and their actions, particularly if there's a track record of bad convictions or overwrought prosecutions. But by and large, prosecutors do very, very good things. And whether it's in public corruption or it's in domestic violence or it's on Wall Street, or you're talking about, you know, people who are at the head of government. There's a lot of debate and conversation about that, too. Justice is also about accountability. And until such time as all human beings stop hurting other human beings, it will be necessary.
So one of the things that I've seen as a theme over and over again in wrongful convictions especially is that at some point, especially in murder cases, which is a lot of what Undisclosed looks at, that the police or the prosecutor's office develop a relationship with victims or the victim's family, that there's then buy-in that the conviction is good because there's been that relationship and that pressure to sort of come through for this family or come through for this victim. How do you overcome that when you realize you made a mistake? Because I've seen family members, I mean, even in the Curtis Flowers case in Mississippi, he was tried 6 times for a crime he clearly did not commit. And now the victims and the victims' families in that crime will never budge. They will never budge because they were sold that he did it for years. So how do you reconcile that? How do you overcome that? Because that's a lot of pressure, right?
Well, that's a very, very difficult thing. And it's something that prosecutors need to be sensitive to. I talk about this in my book a little bit, because two things that are in conflict with each other are true. One is you need to have some detachment, right? I compare being a prosecutor in some ways to being an oncologist, right? It can't be the case that every time you have to tell a patient about a diagnosis of cancer, you go to pieces and you fall apart, right? You have to have some immunity to that. At the same time, you can't become so detached that you don't care and it's pro forma for you, because for that person that you're telling you have cancer, that's probably the worst moment of that person's life. So some amount of detachment, but some amount of empathy and emoting also is important. And the reason I mention it is, I think it's relevant to your question, you can't get overly attached to the patient, because then you can't do your job objectively either. And, you know, I teach a class at NYU Law School, in part based on the themes of the book. And, you know, we address the subject of who is it that the prosecutor represents? Who is the client? The client's the public. The client is not the victim. And in fact, and I mean this with all due respect to victims, because I think, you know, sometimes we have the opposite problem of what you're describing, that the prosecutor doesn't care so much about the victim. You know, we had to pass legislation to make sure that victim, you know, on the federal level, to make sure that prosecutors were, you know, keeping victims apprised of their rights and of the progress of the case. So, you know, both problems exist in the system, not just over buy-in of the victim and over sympathy, but also sometimes too much detachment. You know, you don't know anything. And the following concept sounds odd to say, but it is true. In any criminal case, who's the most biased person that has a stake in the outcome? You know, other than the defendant, it's probably a victim or a relation of the victim. So you have to be careful. So in the case of Sue Ann that I was talking about, it was important for the prosecutors and the investigators in that case to believe in her and help her, because she was someone who was vulnerable and was taken advantage of and was hurt very deeply. At the same time, you have to maintain your objectivity, because, you know, victims come with baggage too. They have faulty memories, they have vendettas. And, you know, it's a long answer because it's a very complicated question, but an excellent one, that I think people just have to be very sensitive to this idea of doing the victim's bidding and getting overly caught up in what a victim or victim's family wants, but at the same time, not dismissing it because it is important what they want. Part of the reason we do this job, I mean, there are prosecutors who do their jobs because they want to get justice for the victims and the families of the victims. Both of those things are true. But I think if the pendulum swings too far in either direction on that spectrum, you get problems like you're talking about. By the way, it's also sometimes the case, you know, victims are not monolithic. You know, in the 9/11 case that we ended up not being able to bring in the Southern District, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others who were still at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, you have a lot of victims' families from 9/11, obviously, thousands of them. Many of them wanted the trial to take place in a military tribunal, perfectly good faith interest that they had. But others wanted them to be tried in an Article III court, in a federal district court in the Southern District of New York. So sometimes what it means to be, you know, complying with the victim's wishes is not even clear because there are multiple victims and they have different views. And that's why your duty is always to the public and to justice, not to any individual particular victim who feels strongly about a particular thing.
So, Susan, let's talk about this week's episode on the Titus case. This week we heard about how the cold case team got a search warrant for Jeff Titus's farm and found items of evidence, in quotey quotes, including a mass market movie and a book, both about snipers. Is this relevant that in a murder case that somebody has a book and a movie in their house about a subject that they're interested in?
I don't know. Pri, would you have ever brought up in trial that the defendant in the case owned a book called Dead Center about snipers and therefore has an intense interest in one shot, one kill, and therefore probably killed the victim with one shot?
So I generally have a habit of not opining on a legal question when I know nothing about the case. I haven't read anything about the case. That's the quickest way to get in trouble.
Yeah.
So I always dodge these questions by saying it depends on the circumstances. And look, in any criminal trial, depending on what the facts are, things can be relevant. It also can be true that there are coincidences and things can be unduly prejudicial because of the way juries might think about them.
Hmm.
What do you guys think?
I don't think that possessing a mass market book that is typical, that's something that you expect to find anywhere, is relevant evidence in any case, really, but especially not this one.
Well, look, it reminds me of a case that I talk about in the book, but it's not in the podcast series. You know, my best friend in high school was good friends with the Menendez family. And I don't remember now if this ever got introduced or not, but I think I thought a piece of evidence, it's been a lot of years. Remember Lyle and Eric Menendez?
Oh, yeah.
Confessed to shooting their parents to death in their home in Beverly Hills. I think they found on one of the boys' computers, I might be totally wrong in having a false memory because I'm old and decrepit, so you can cut all this if this is wrong, but I thought that they found a screenplay or a play,
right,
in which the plot was parenticide. I don't know if that was deemed relevant or not, but, you know, there's an argument there. That's different from buying a mass market book, though.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I say this on this show a lot, that if you are of the mind that somebody is guilty, then almost anything can make them look that way. I mean, I always use the example of, like, if I kill my husband, the last text exchange we had where we bickered about something will be used as evidence in my trial. You know, if my husband shows up dead, not if I killed him, because I wouldn't do that. But that seems to be the case in a big way in the Titus case. And another example of that is that the cold case team believes that his demeanor during the search of his property was evidence of his guilt. So we have another question of whether or not someone is, quote, acting guilty, and that demeanor is now seen as evidence. Susan, what did you think about that?
I mean, you hear the prosecutor Fitton say in this episode that because Titus's response to a question from the detective was not to immediately say, I'm innocent, you're looking in the wrong place, I'm innocent, that means he's guilty. They also, of course, think his face makes him look guilty, that his books make him look guilty. It's really a pretty extreme case of no matter what Titus does, it makes him look guilty.
Right.
And particularly in this issue with the search warrant, when they're talking to him, I bet a lot of money that if Titus had said what Fitton says he should have, that would be used as evidence that he was guilty.
he just keeps saying
he's innocent.
That's a pretty good test for whether or not something should come in or is probative, that if you engage in the thought experiment of thinking, you know, he said X, is that evidence of something? well, what if he said the opposite of X? Would that also be used by the prosecutor to say something? And if that the answer to that is likely yes, then you probably can't use it.
Preet, one of the interesting things about the Titus case, and I think that Susan won't mind my saying this because a lot of people say it on the podcast, is that he's not a likable guy. Like, a lot of people did not like him. He has a very off-putting affect. All he talks about is hunting and killing animals. He's intense. He's not particularly social. He doesn't have great social skills. Do you think it's more difficult when there's an exoneration case or a case where someone is trying to look into an exoneration when you have a truly unlikable defendant?
You know, I guess you hope that would not be true, because likability has no relationship to guilt or innocence. But, you know, as I say all the time, my favorite tautology, you know, everyone is a human being. And that's true of judges. That's true of lawyers. That's true of witnesses. And so I imagine, like in every other aspect of our life, even though we probably don't like it and don't like to admit it, you know, that plays a role in how hard people want to fight for somebody. You know, I don't think it should be that way. And, you know, the opposite is also true. It should not be a factor.
Yeah. And it didn't surprise me it was going to be. I think I was surprised at how much it was a factor, and this or has been in this case. You can definitely tell that people have a different response to Titus's case because they personally think they wouldn't like him. And having talked to him, he is not what I expected, just because of all these transcripts that paint him to be such an unlikable person. He is very much a human who is likable and charming in his own way. But, you know, someone who might appeal to a smaller segment of the population the most. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, but the opposite problem also arises. You know, episode 4 of the podcast is going to talk about a gentleman who was well-heeled, educated, charming, debonair, did well, had a lot of friends in high places. And so he was super likable. And his super likability, I think, was the reason why years went by before people realized that he was defrauding banks to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. So this issue of, like, you know, likability and whether or not someone seems like they're capable of doing this bad thing, or on the other side of the coin, seem incapable of doing that terrible thing. I mean, look at Bernie Madoff. So you have to be, I think on both sides of the coin, you have to be worried about making assumptions about people's guilt or innocence or goodness or badness based on their personality.
Yeah, no kidding. Susan, Junior Fred Blackston wrote a letter to Titus in jail saying that this guy Lamp was the real killer. Why did the defense believe these claims? And do you think there's any validity to this theory?
From what I have seen, I think it's likely that the defense team did believe it, like, subjectively. I've not been able to speak to them, so I can't confirm that. But from their writings and from the materials that we have, it seems like, Howard Swabash especially actually believed this letter. And I think it was kind of a tunnel vision effect, the reverse way. Only instead of a prosecutor doing it, it was a defense team who has, earlier in the case, this new suspect thrown their way. And they're like, heck yeah, this is the real guy. Let's do it. And they spend their entire pretrial time making a case against someone for whom there's not really any evidence to show they were involved. And that tunnel vision prevents them from doing other acts that I think it's obvious, especially in hindsight, would have been much more effective in preparing for trial.
Hmm. Is that a danger, Preet, focusing so much on, you know, this other guy did it, that you don't do the thing where you're proving that your guy didn't?
Yeah, I think so. Look, the most important thing, and a lot of this conversation reminds me of what investigators have said, and that is you have to keep an open mind even after you've convicted somebody, right? You know, if you have a thesis of a case, even if it's based on pretty decent evidence, you have a problem, because coincidences do happen in life and miscarriages of justice do happen in life. And there's confirmation bias, which is, I think, responsible for a lot of this. You don't undo your thesis. I think it's absolutely a problem.
Isn't it hard to prove that someone didn't do something, though? I mean, you were talking earlier about how hard it is to make a case that someone's guilty. I find it in my own life, not even as a prosecutor, but just as a person, harder to find out that someone wasn't someplace. I mean, I wrote 4 true crime books, and we looked into things all the time, details of things that people said. When someone lies, it's easier to prove that they're lying than it is to prove that they're telling the truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's sort of a philosophical conundrum in life. And look, you're never going to have a perfect system in which you always get it right, because we're not omniscient. We don't live in a full-on surveillance state. And we try to deal with that by you know, giving people certain rights, like the Fifth Amendment, right against self-incrimination, which I think is maybe the most protective right we have in the Constitution when it comes to criminal justice. You need to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We have a high burden. We have to have unanimity in almost every jurisdiction in the country of the jury. So, you know, you have these protections, but when you have millions of cases that get done on an annual basis, you know, some are going to get, you know, messed up.
Another thing that happened in this case was that two of the witnesses say that they worked at the sawmill, and they say that they heard Jeff Titus making incriminating remarks when he came in to use the services of the sawmill. And then one of their wives, it was their wife, right, Susan Marion Gibbs?
Yes, yeah, Lee Gibbs' wife.
Right, says that she was there when these statements were made, but you haven't been able to in any way prove that she was there. And in fact, one of the men says she was not there, right?
Yeah, she testified at trial. Her husband did too. It never occurred to me that there might be an issue here when I started. But I knew from the case file that there was an employee of the sawmill, really a partner, 50-50, in the operations there, who had been talked to much sooner than Marion had, who had been given a couple statements about the day Titus came in and acted weird at the sawmill. He wasn't called to testify. And I was like, well, maybe they wanted two witnesses and didn't need three. And I went and talked to him. He was not someone who is in favor of promoting Titus's innocence.
Yeah, he actually said that. I don't want to be involved in the exoneration, right?
Yep. And he had no idea that Marion testified. And when I talked to him, he was pretty shocked. You could tell that he like wished he had not said any of this. But he said, no, Marion wasn't there. And Marion's testimony at trial was dramatic, a fairly vivid account of like a detailed account of Titus saying things that were highly incriminating. Really the most incriminating statement by far of any of the witnesses who came in and said Titus said something. Hers were like very detailed and would make Titus look very guilty.
But she's in the podcast, Susan, and she sounds still very, very sure that she was there and remembers
this. She is very sure.
Has she basically inserted herself in her memory into a story that did not take place in front of her? I mean, that is a thing. You don't remember events. You remember your memory of events. That's how it works. Is that what you think is going on here? Or do you think that she's just not telling the truth?
That's an option I considered, having spoken to her. You know, I've got one person saying one thing, another saying the other. This many years on, how do you tell who's telling the truth? I will say that Steve McCumber's statements to me have all been very consistent with his past statements, like the evidence, everything. Marion's stories have a lot of problems, and problems that are hard for me to reconcile with the idea she is having an emotional memory of something, as opposed to, for instance, her story at trial for why she was there to hear this conversation, because Titus came by on a weekday and she had a full-time job at the VA where he also worked. So she, in order to explain why she was even here at the sawmill to hear this, she told the court and testified that every year she took the first 2 weeks of deer season off so that she could hunt. And then during the day in between hunting in the evening and morning, she would work at the sawmill. I talked to her. I'm like asking her why she's there. And I said, well, did you take time off, to go hunting during deer season? She's like, no, I never did that. So on a number of points, her story has basically been entirely transformed from what it was.
Right.
It seems very likely that she did in fact perjure herself.
Wow. So, Preet, listen to this. You ready? We heard in this last episode that one of the witnesses in this case ended up being the foreman on Jeff Titus's jury. Susan, how the hell did that happen?
I do not know.
And that was not disclosed?
No, no one really. I do actually believe. I think it's very possible that that the prosecutor and the defense didn't notice. There was a pretty lengthy witness list, so I think it's possible no one just put two and two together until somehow during deliberations, like day two deliberations, Someone figures it out and goes to the court and says, oh my God, we just realized that this foreman of the jury, they just picked a foreman and he's actually one of the witnesses in the case.
No, but didn't the juror himself understand that he was a witness in the case when, as he was learning about the case?
Exactly. That's what I was wondering. Because that's a blanket question during voir dire. Like that, I've been a jury foreman before, and they had like before the jury was picked, they had like 30 of us up there, and they ask blanket questions, and you're supposed to raise your hand if the answer is yes or no to them, and then you say, okay, you go sit down. Isn't that a standard question? Do you know any of the witnesses or defendant?
Yes, in fact, this is a thing that usually happens. Yes, it did. What the judge says when it comes up is like, well, maybe he forgot he was a witness. The trial was the case was a long time ago. So what happens then is the defense attorney is asked, like, do you want to do anything about it? And he's like, nah, it's fine. Like, do you want to question the juror? And he's like, no, I think the appellate courts wouldn't like that. Well, you're a defense attorney, so I think that there's nothing that could possibly be bad for you to go ahead and question this juror. If you're not going to go ask for a mistrial, at least do that.
It's not going to get worse for you.
At least ask if he knew. Yeah. Yeah.
It can only get better.
But his reasoning was that, yeah. So there's no questioning. There's no follow-up. And this particular juror was... also in law enforcement. So again, someone you probably wouldn't want to have in your jury if you're a defense attorney. Way too close to the case. And in fact, was the one who, from what we can tell, may have, if not single-handedly, very strongly converted the jurors who wanted to acquit to a guilty verdict.
By the way, kudos to you for all the sourcing in this podcast. You actually have that juror in the podcast talking about why he thought Jeff Titus was guilty. And I didn't really understand it. I mean, he basically said that Jeff Titus, by the way, Preet, had a extremely solid alibi. He was with another man, a smart man, hunting in a whole other place that was miles and miles and miles away from where these murders took place. But this juror was somehow convinced that this very smart man wasn't where he thought he was when he was with Jeff Titus. He thought he was tricked into thinking he was like 40 miles away or whatever. It's bananas, right, Susan?
It is. I think there's a certain sort of degree of people making assumptions based on who Jeff is. Hmm. They think that Jeff is a weird guy and possibly a violent guy from what they've heard. They think he's maybe not as well educated. You know, I think there's some kind of class issues going here where they see Stan Driscoll, the double PhD, who's kind of stately and has an academic and overly verbose way of talking.
I call him the Comey of this case is what he is.
They did not interpret that as a friendship. They were friends. They hunted together as friends. Every year they went and hunted out the Crandall Shepherd Farms. But because they can't process that, the jury seems to have decided, oh, they weren't friends. This was like a hunting guide arrangement where this guy, Stan, paid Jeff to take him out hunting. And that's why he wouldn't know where he was. When in reality, they were hunting friends. He went hunting together every single year.
I have a question for you, Preet, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this case. I just want to know if this has ever happened to you, okay? So this guy, the alibi witness, is one of these people that is so precise in the way that he talks that he won't say, if he doesn't know something, he'll say he doesn't know it, but in a way that makes it seem like he's going in the other direction, like he knows it not to be true. But what he's actually doing is he's saying, you know, did you ever hear Jeff say this? And if he doesn't remember, he will say, I can't say that I ever remember him saying that. But he won't say, you know what, that sounds like something he did say to me. I just don't remember it exactly. He'll never kind of go to the place where he's, you know, sort of relying on his gut or his instinct or even some knowledge he does have. If the question is literally worded, he will answer it so literally that it's actually damaging. Have you ever dealt with a person like this?
None off the top of my head. And look, in some ways, it sounds like the ideal. You know, what's that famous?
You would think
trick that lawyers use with their that lawyers use with their clients before they get their deposition taken or before they go testify. And you'll say in an offhanded way in the conference room, "Do you know what time it is?" And they'll say, "You know, 12:45." Like, "Oh, I didn't ask you what time it is. I said, do you know what time it is?" The correct answer to that question is yes or no. And it sounds like this guy has taken that lesson to an extreme.
Yes.
He is that guy 1,000%. His way of understanding his requirements is he believed it would be essentially perjury to say yes to something he was 99% sure of, but not 100% sure of.
And not say, I'm only 99% sure.
The answer is no, yeah.
All right, so there's one more thing that we have to talk about before we end this. And I really am excited to hear Preet's reaction to this one.
Uh-oh.
So there was a defense investigator working for Jeff Titus, doing his defense investigation, as one does when one is a defense investigator. He ends up marrying Jeff Titus's wife. They end up, they're having a relationship.
What?
Apparently they have a relationship that has started at some point in this timeline during this process, because he actually accompanies Jeff's wife to prison after he's convicted so that she can tell Jeff she's breaking up with him to be with this defense investigator. Preet, thoughts?
Very shortly after, too.
Yeah, you heard my thoughts. They were expressed in surprised laughter. Did something happen to the investigator?
Cake. What's that?
Was there any action taken against the investigator?
No.
And did this come out? When did this come out?
Very shortly after. Presumably they met. So technically it was a couple months after he was sentenced to life in prison that they came to the prison to tell him this. So maybe it started in the past 2 months. Who knows? But they're still married today, and it does raise a question, especially given how little work the investigator did. He talked to like 2 of the 39 witnesses the prosecutor called. Right. He was focused on this bad suspect that was like the entire defense.
Well,
in this case,
it sounds like he was focused on the wife.
Yeah, he was focused on something else. Yeah,
I'm also not sure what you're gonna. I keep thinking, what are you gonna tell me next? That the judge was married to one of the murder victims?
Oh, this is the most incestuous story you've ever heard. There's like the fact that this witness worked with Jeff Titus at the VA and then also was a witness at her other job about something he said, when we know that everyone at the VA, like a lot of people there, didn't like him. So she was probably predisposed to not like him as well. Like
Yes, in fact, she had a lot of stories too about the VA and what a bad coworker he was.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. There's a lot of that in this case. It's really, I mean, like every case that Undisclosed does, is there always some bananas aspect to it, but this one is like extra bananas as far
extra
as I can
bananas.
Tell.
Well, it sounds like it.
Well, Susan, we have a lot of other details about witnesses and stuff that I want to get to on next week's addendum. I got a little bit caught up interrogating Preet Bharara there for a few minutes. So, Preet Bharara, I want to give you the opportunity before we wrap up, tell everyone the name of your new podcast and
yes.
how they can get it.
It's called Doing Justice. It's based on my book, which you can also get, Doing Justice. It's available wherever you listen to your podcast. That's how they teach us to say it. Search Doing Justice, and it's a free, limited series narrative podcast about crime, justice, and all sorts of things that you like to listen to on this podcast. 6 episodes. The first episode is already up.
Listen, you have learned well from your podcast masters how to talk about that. That was perfect. Susan
Thank
Simpson,
you.
Thanks so much for giving me the dirt on the stuff going on behind the scenes in the case once again. Thanks so much. What can we expect to hear next week?
Next week we'll hear about really the prosecution's only piece of evidence that actually links Titus to the crime. And that's Bonnie Huffman.
Hmm. All right. I can't wait to hear that. Preet Bharara, it was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Treat for me. Thank you, guys.
And thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum. Do you have a question for the next addendum? Tips about any of the cases covered on Undisclosed? You can email questions to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them along with your tips on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Audio production for the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. Follow the show on social media everywhere at Undisclosed Pod. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. And for everyone at Undisclosed, have a great week. We'll catch you next time.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com. At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.